The name of our podcast, Tech Sequences, is really a mashup of two words, technology and consequences. We are fascinated by the consequences, intended or unintended, of the internet and related technologies for the way we live, play, and work. We are your hosts, Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. We started our careers at the dawn of the internet and have been friends, colleagues, and comrades in arms for the better part of 20 years. In this podcast, we examine the impact internet-related technologies have made or may make in our lives. I'm Alexa Rod.
And I'm Leslie Daigle.
Welcome to Tech Sequences. In 1903, Mark Twain penned an impassioned letter to his friend Helen Keller. In the letter, he addresses an accusation of plagiarism directed at Keller some 11 years prior, when her short story, The Frost King, was found to be notably similar to author Margaret Canby's short story, Frost Fairies. Although Keller, at the time 11 or 12 years old, was acquitted of the charges, it nevertheless made a permanent impression on them both. In the letter, Twain rails against what he deemed a farce, writing, "As if there was much of anything in human utterance, oral or written, except plagiarism. The kernel, the soul, let us go further and say the substance, the bulk, the actual and valuable material of all human utterances is plagiarism, or substantially all ideas are secondhand. Although plagiarism is a matter of honor, the fundamental issue is still unauthorized use of someone else's work. And even though Mark Twain steadfastly declares to Keller that there is no original work, our current system of copyright and intellectual property laws believes otherwise. Today, copyright is everywhere. Chances are you are surrounded by copyrighted works in your home, your office, on your computer screen, and your smartphone. And most likely, you have read about some battle over AI's use of copyright or whether some creation of an AI system can be copyrighted. The fundamental assumptions behind our system of copyright laws are that A, humans are capable of creating innovative and original works, and that B, they, the creators, ought to have exclusive rights to control and benefit from their creative works. These assumptions raise a whole host of questions in the age of AI. Does our system of copyright laws truly benefit those for whom it was intended? Should makers of AI systems compensate artists and writers for using their works to train their AI systems? Given that most copyright laws predate the digital revolution, how applicable are they now in the age of AI? As with most complex questions, the answer must include an unvarnished examination of long-held assumptions, outcomes, and a nuanced consideration of ethical principles, property rights, and economic fairness.
Our guests today are David Bellis and Alex Montague. They are co-authors of the book, Who Owns This Sentence? A History of Copyrights and Wrongs, a New York Times Book Review Editor's Choice, and a New Yorker Best Book Choice for 2024. David Bellis is currently the Meredith Howland Pine Professor of French and Comparative Literature at Princeton. Born in the UK and educated at Oxford, he was previously head of modern languages at Manchester University in England. He is the author of many books and articles on 19th and 20th century French literature and a renowned translator of modern French literature. Alex Montague is a practicing lawyer and the founding partner of Montague Law, focusing on intellectual property law, in particular in the context of technology, new media, and artificial intelligence. He is the author of many articles on various aspects of intellectual property, as well as a book entitled Intellectual Property, Money, and Power in a New Era. He is a speaker at legal conferences on intellectual property, most recently speaking on the topic of intellectual property and artificial intelligence. Alex is a graduate of Princeton, Cambridge, and Harvard Law School. Welcome, David and Alex.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So you were co-authors of the book, Who Owns This Sentence? History of Copyrights and Wrongs. What prompted you to write this book?
Well, it's all Alex's fault, really. As you said, he's a distinguished alum of the Comparative Literature Department at Princeton, which is my current attachment. And he subsequently became a lawyer and a member of the department's advisory board, which is a collection of distinguished external people who come and descend upon us every couple of years and tell us how well we're doing, except that on one occasion he came and said, no, you're not doing very well, because as a department of comparative literature, you really ought to be educating your students about copyright law and its engagement with the history of Western cultures. And so he's more or less challenged us to introduce a course on the history of copyright. I'm a sort of a Muggins and I take on jobs nobody else wants. So I said, all right, I'll do it. And so we got together and he started educating me and I scrabbled off to the library and educated myself a bit more. And we taught a course about 5 years ago. And the students were wonderful, and it turned out to be really very interesting. So we taught it again, and Alex came down from New York once and even twice a week, which was quite a thing for him to do in his busy life. And then all of a sudden he decided that he would move to London. So we couldn't teach the course as a double act anymore. And so there was nothing left but to write the book.
Very well done. And as you note in the book, the copyright laws can trace their start to early 18th century England. So can you set the context a little bit of how and why the copyright laws were created back then?
Well, I'll put it this way. Prior to the end of the 17th century, in England as in France, there were cartels of printers who were established by law as the only legal printers of anything. And so once a London printer who was a member of that guild, the Stationers' Company, had acquired a manuscript from an author and obtained the privilege, or rather awarded himself the privilege of publishing it, because they were statutorily enabled to do that on behalf of the Crown, the work, its actual literal expression, belonged to that publisher as a property, and they treated it, you know, like you would treat a house or a car. They called them copies. They're copies. Copy not in the sense of a duplicate, but of the thing itself, like in, you know, the text. Copy meant text, as it does when you talk about a copy editor today. What changed in 1710 was a new law that brought some order to a system that had got into chaos for purely political and temporary reasons. And it did so by attributing to the author or to the person the author sold the work to a limited property right, first of all, for 14 years, and that could be renewed for another 14 if the author was still alive at the termination of the first license. So that is generally regarded in all the histories as the beginning of copyright, or the first assertion of an author's property rights in his work, though actually they had a property right beforehand in the sense that they would sell their manuscripts to the publishers. I mean, Milton got £20 for Paradise Lost, for example. It wasn't that they were, as it were, completely robbed. But the new system meant that that property expired after a relatively short period. And it meant that the publishers, who considered themselves to be owners of, you know, Shakespeare, or Milton, or whatever, were no longer the permanent owners. So although the Statute of Anne wasn't really put into effect for a generation or two after that, because publishers have dragged their feet over all of this and very successfully dragged their feet for many decades, the fundamental position from the 18th century was that most books, all books not less than 28 years old, belong to nobody, belong to the public. And we must see copyright not as so much as the beginning of authors' property, as the beginning of the assertion of a wide, capacious public domain, so that any printer could print a new edition of Chaucer or Homer or Virgil or Dante or whatever in the 18th century. They didn't, in fact, until a court case in 1774 that went all the way to the Supreme Court of the UK at the time, the House of Lords, reaffirmed the actual literal meaning of the Statute of Anne and really did deprive the publishers of their view that they should own stuff forever. So that's how it began. But what's happened is, I'm sure Alex will explain at greater length, is that since then, little by little, bit by bit, the owners of the channels, if you like, of the mediums of distribution, have got it all back. And that today, most copyrights belong to large corporations for a century or more, which, as far as I'm concerned, is eternity. My age. Like forever and ever.
Yes, I was looking up, for example, the Elvis's song catalog is not really owned by the Elvis estate. Bruce Springsteen, for example, doesn't own his own song catalog, neither do the Beatles. But let's talk about more about property rights and wealth and what's happened since then, since the 18th century. What are some significant changes and developments that challenge the assumptions underlying this property rights and the creation of wealth?
Well, can I just make one point clear, is that everything that David described that went down in the 18th century, the Statute of Anne and its clarification in the Donaldson and Becket case, it all applied to books.
Mm.
Copyright was limited to books. And in the 18th century, books were not the dominant engine of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
It were, I would say, something that was a niche. They were there mostly for entertainment and education. But the dominant engine of the economy in the 18th century was land, as it had been for centuries, since feudal times. So this was the copyright issue was not as significant as it is today, because today land is no longer the dominant engine of our economy. Intellectual capital, intellectual property is the dominant engine of our economy, and the intellectual property consists of different types of laws and protections, but I would say that copyright has become probably the most important one because of its length, because it is now life of author plus 70 years, which is well over 100 years of protection. In the 18th century, as David was explaining, the protection was limited to 28 years. And also because copyright has been extended to all sorts of things, and in particular to computer software and computer code, which means that as computers, as our economy has become more and more dependent on technology and computers, the underlying protection that those technologies enjoy is provided by copyright law for a very long time. And so this has profound effects on our economy and on our social life, on the way we live. And one of the things that the House of Lords in the Donaldson case noted in deciding that the term of copyright was limited to 14 years and a renewal period of another 14 years was the importance of the public interest. And in that time, the public interest was to have affordable books. Otherwise, the publishers would have pushed up the prices in order to make a lot of profit. And so they noted that, and they made that decision. That figured very importantly. Well, that's a consideration that I think applies today as well, that in that there's so much that's now locked up under copyright. And so as a result, the public pays a great deal more without really realizing it, because this isn't really something that's discussed. Certainly not discussed publicly when we talk about how things, you know, the cost of living crisis, how much more things cost. We generally think, okay, well, how much more does, you know, petrol or gas or, you know, things like that cost? We don't think about how much more do computers cost? How much more does information cost? How much more do films cost? All of these things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, they're more expensive because of these underlying protections, intellectual property protections, the main one being copyright, but others as well.
And I would observe that the cost comes in two forms, right? I mean, your original description of costs, the publishers could have raised the cost of books, and that was a concern. It's not just raising costs for access to individual books and or software today, it's also controlled access, right? Because the publisher can elect not to publish something it controls.
Yes.
Absolutely. I mean,
that was a worry in the 18th century. Ownership of Hamlet, for example, as the Tonsons claimed to have, meant that only the Tonsons could print copies of it. It also meant that the Tonsons could decide not to print copies of it. Copyright is control as well as rent. Yeah. I do want to just add something to what Alex said. The change, the transformation of copyright from the creation of a large public domain to the virtual extinction of the public domain as we have today, did not happen because anybody sat down and thought about it. It did not happen because there was a revolution or a reconsideration of what copyright was for. It happened in tiny little haphazard stages as it spread, first of all, to domains other than printed books, and then it spread to other dimensions of the book other than simply reprinting a copy, and it spread by getting ever longer. And these things happened in basically a very uncoordinated way, a little bit in England, a little bit in America, a little bit in France, and then they leapfrogged each other, and then through the etc. And that's why we felt it was necessary to write a more historical book about copyright, so that we understand that the way it is now is not the product of any sort of joined up thinking. It's the product of a kind of a higgledy-piggledy history of patchwork and extensions in which unintended consequences, sheer greed, manipulation, capture of market, all these things play their roles here and there to lead to where we are today.
So one of the other things that's changed considerably in the interim as well is who or what is consuming the written text. And of course, a raging debate now is the training of large language model AI systems, generative AI systems, and that are consuming vast quantities of text in ways that were they human would be considered fair use. But I guess the raging question now is it fair use if you've got a computer that's reading? Any beginning reflections on how that fits or where it should go?
Let me just add, sorry, it's text and images, right?
Where everything that's protected, yes, which is everything.
Yeah, it's text, images, it's also sound. Anything that is within copyright, which is likely, anything that was created in the last 100 years is likely to be in copyright. And this is worldwide, because now we have almost every country in the world that has signed on to this Berne Convention, which is this convention, a treaty that provides minimum terms of protection for works that are created in all these countries. So if you publish a work in Switzerland, it automatically has protection, copyright protection in the US. So you can't get around this by, jumping, jurisdictions. Now, as you said, with AI, the issue is that in the way that the AI machines learn is by repeated exposure to the underlying material. So for example, if you're training an AI to recognize a cat, then you expose that AI to millions of photographs of a cat. Or if you're training an AI to perform songs in the manner of a certain performer, you expose the AI to that performer's songs, and then the AI can replicate that. The AI's replication is not a direct copy. It learns how to do it and then it performs. So it's a bit like a human that learns. But the thing is that in the process of doing that, it has to make copies. It makes internal copies. And that is an issue that is disputed in terms of some of the ML learning. But I think that in most cases, there is a copy that's made. So there is a legal argument that sort of interim copying is not considered copyright infringement because it's not sufficiently fixed. That the issue hasn't really been decided. It's in the works. But the bigger issue is that even if a copy is an interim copy is made, and even if that's considered to be an unlawful copy, the fact that the output is not a direct copy is not an infringement because it's a fair use, as you said. So that's the big question. And there are lawsuits going on right now. The New York Times has brought one. Getty Images has brought one. Their claim against Stability AI and its Stable Diffusion intelligence platform. So we'll see how these cases are decided. But if you notice one thing about the cases is that the plaintiffs and the defendants are all large corporations.
Yeah, I was going to point that out. It's very interesting because some of the articles that you read is about the right of the artists and the creators for being compensated for their work. But then in reality, a lot of these lawsuits are with very big corporations. So let's talk about wealth and wealth concentration in terms of copyright. How has that changed now? I mentioned that some of these big song catalogs are not owned by the artists. Is that just a example, a kind of isolated example, or throughout, if you look at it, is that more of the norm?
Ownership is slightly beside the point, especially in legislations like that of the EU, where the actual moral right to be the author of a work is something that can't be sold or alienated. But in fact, to get anything out there, to publish a book, to launch a song, etc., you license a publisher, a music publisher, to exploit your copyright for the duration of copyright. Mm-hmm. So that comes to exactly the same thing as selling it to him for 100 years, even mm-hmm. if it's like verbally or legally, the copyright, there's still on the front of our book, it says copyright David Belsen. It doesn't mean anything. Norton have the right to do everything they want to with it for the natural duration of copyright, minus one or two tiny things that are somewhere buried in the 17-page contract. The actual creator really isn't in a position to assert his or her ownership, because for the book to have been published, he or she has to have already licensed its exploitation to an owner of a channel that has the means to bring it to a public. So that that's the situation, and it's got like that over the centuries, bit by bit. I mean, reversing the Donaldson decision of the late 18th century in various stages, but I guess the most important of which was at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, where it was asserted that for the purposes of copyright law, an employer may be an author. That's actually in the 1911 US copyright law. From that point on, the word author in copyright law really ceases to mean author. It means the firm or company to which the exploitation of the copyright has been ceded, or to whom it belongs, in the sense that if you write a song whilst being employed by a song company, the copyright belongs to the song company. And so we've now got a century of experience of what happens when effectively you go back to the 17th century system where the publishers actually own the work to all practical purposes, all practical extents. That's one of the things that we try to explain in our book, and about which I suppose, well, we're not exactly revolutionary. We do suggest that this is, well, it's potentially not even constitutional, because the Constitution allows Congress to pass laws to encourage the sciences and the arts by giving authors ownership of their work.
Now, if we talk about author as the creator of a code, because it's one thing for an author to write a book and publish that, but if the author is creator of computer code, if you think about it, it's almost never the individual coder that is asserting the copyright. It's always the corporation for whom the individual coders have worked. So most recent case on this, which is I think the biggest IP case, was a case that was decided 2 years ago by the Supreme Court, a case that was brought by Oracle against Google, for Oracle claimed that Google had infringed the copyright in its APIs. And APIs are a form of computer code. They're not exactly computer code, but they're related, a form of computer code. And one of the questions in the case was whether or not APIs are copyrightable. And in the end, the Supreme Court said, we're not going to decide if APIs are copyrightable because we don't have to. We're deciding that Google's use was a fair use. So they disposed of it in that way. But the reason that I'm bringing up this case is that if you think about this idea that copyright is meant to reward the individual creator, and then you apply copyright protection to computer code, then it's a bit hard to square those two things together. How is copyright rewarding the individual creator?
Yeah, interesting. Right?
And think about the case of Oracle versus Google, where there were billions of dollars of at stake in damages, potentially. Who would those damages have benefited? If Google had been found to have been infringing, and if it wasn't fair use, who would that copyright have benefited? Would it have benefited the individual creators? I'm asking the question.
Mm-hmm.
And remembering also that this term has been extended for so long, which is one of the reasons that in that case, Oracle dropped its patent claims because they realized that copyright damages would be much more significant than any patent damages that they would get. So the case morphed into a copyright case.
One of the differences with code versus books is that our experience of code, or at least the code that upon which we rely most often, is generally created for commercial purposes, and people do it in their day jobs mostly. I mean, there are people who code for open source on the side, but it is also a collective effort generally, which is a little bit different than most plays that get written by at least, you know, at most two or three people, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go back a little bit to a point you made a little bit ago, David, where you said that the purpose of the copyright or the ceding of the rights was to take the work to the public. Mm. And I think part of the challenge that we have here is that the public has changed, right? And so if you take the example, let's pick on Taylor Swift, because, you know, here's someone who has re-recorded her entire library because she didn't have rights to the original recordings. But suppose an AI gets trained on Taylor Swift songs and then generates a new song in the style of Taylor Swift that, you know, goes to number one on the pop charts, for instance, because people can't tell it's not Taylor Swift. And let's make it even worse. Let's suppose it espouses beliefs that are at odds with Taylor Swift's own beliefs. I don't know. I'm not going to attempt to make up an example of what that might be. But so the harm then is leveraging something about her works in order to deceive people, make money, and also, you know, bring in the concept of going against the original author's sensibilities.
Well, I think there are two quite separate questions there, and that they're both pretty dreadful ones, or deep ones. I mean, capacity of an AI device, let us suppose, to produce a perfect pastiche raises the question as to whom does the copyright of that pastiche belong? It's a conundrum, and it's got some nasty twists in it, because on the one hand, you could say it belongs to nobody. And the reasons for saying it belongs to nobody is that nobody created it, and that copyright laws, the language of copyright laws, remain hypocritically, but nonetheless verbally, bound up with the idea of original authorship. But then you have in the public sphere a terrible problem. How do you know which songs you're listening to are copyright protected and which ones aren't? You can have a kind of mad muddle of a sudden emergence of an unrecognizable public domain. On the other hand, if you assert that the copyright of the pastiche, because it was produced by a machine using an algorithm, which is itself copyright, or rather the code for that algorithm is itself copyright, therefore the Taylor Swift number one lookalike hit belongs to the owner of the copyrights in the software. Well, that's dreadful, because then we enter a world where little by little, absolutely everything will belong to a small handful of very large companies. And we will be, you know, like medieval serfs, where everything belonged to the feudal barons, if not to the king. Neither of these outturns is at all desirable. But to be quite honest, I do not know what the right outturn should or could be, or whether we just have to stop AI from doing any such thing. The other question you raise is the question of moral rights. Now, they are not well recognized in the US, but they are very firm in the EU, in EU law, and certainly under French law, we can be quite sure that Taylor Swift would be absolutely entitled to ban the distribution of any such pastiche. But in the US, well, Alex will tell us, I think it might be more difficult.
Yeah, it would be more difficult unless it's promoted. In the US, copyright wouldn't prevent, so I'd have to think about how that would be framed, but it certainly couldn't be distributed as a Taylor Swift song. In other words, they can't use Taylor Swift's trademark. There is also a law called that prevents you from using someone's image or voice for profit. And so maybe perhaps you could, that's very difficult because it isn't her voice, actually. Yeah. I'm thinking, so yeah. It's not her voice. So you're not using her voice unlawfully. So I don't see how that could come into play. So I think it would be, if you're not promoting it as a Taylor Swift song, you're just putting it out there.
Alex, I think you would go back to the famous Chaplin case, where there was a Mexican scam artist called Amador who made Chaplin lookalike movies under the name of Charlie Applin.
no confusion there.
That's right. Up to that point, in the music hall and in the cinema, you know, everything was really free for the taking. It was a culture of copying and ripping off. But at this point, Chaplin, who was a very dominant figure already, it really got up his nose, and he sued to have the Charlie Applin, they weren't exactly parodies, they were lookalike comedies, taken out of circulation. And the case was very complicated. And the judgment was such a judgment of Solomon that the New York Times reported on one day, Chaplin wins case. And the next day, Chaplin loses suit. And nobody was quite sure who'd won what, but the laws right. under which Aplin was, or Amador was restrained were more to do with deceptive advertising and misleading the public and selling goods trademark. Under a false name. Much more trademark and commercial law, because copyright law couldn't really cope with it, as Alex suggests it still can't today in the days of AI and even more perfect lookalike.
Yeah, just to kind of raise a little bit up to the macro level, and hopefully we haven't given anybody an idea of creating an AI-generated Taylor Swift music. But one of the things you mentioned was, number one, this misconception that copyright laws are really benefiting the individual creator and artist. And the second issue is this concentration of wealth. Can you talk a little bit about what are some of the consequences of this system, copyright system, that was really created in the 18th century and little by little sort of encroached in all these other areas? How has that, what have been the consequences other than, let's say, concentration of wealth and power? Some of the things I'm trying to drive at is also the difference in cultural differences between sort of the Western world and the Eastern world. You have China a lot of times being accused of taking textbooks, you know, and reproducing them without copyright.
Shall I answer that one, Alex?
Yes, go ahead.
What China is doing or is accused of doing now, the US really understands, because that's exactly how the United States worked for the whole of the 19th century. The US did not recognize foreign copyrights, nor did Russia. And the US education system was built on reprinted books from England and France and Germany without so much as a request for permission. New countries do that. They object to the ownership of the things they want by foreign entities. Now, China has copyright laws that are very similar to those of the US actually now, and it belongs to the Bern Union and to the World Trade Organization. And in principle, China operates like the global regime, within the confines of the global regime. Whether it actually does so or not is what the argument is about. There's no need to change Chinese laws to bring it into line. It's the implementation of it that people continue to be suspicious about. But, you know, to be honest, I wouldn't blame the Chinese for doing that. Well, it's because it's how cultures build themselves and yes. always have done.
So in a way, these copyright laws, what you're saying, have really encouraged this disparity, in a way, between the developed world and the developing world.
They not merely encourage it, they create it. Most copyrights of any commercial value belong to large entities based in the UK, the EU, and the US. The US has a huge balance of trade surplus in what it receives in license fees for copyrights owned here and what it pays out in permissions for the reuse here of copyrights that are owned elsewhere, a surplus of around $80 billion a year. I mean, you know, that's bigger than pharmaceuticals. Yeah. That's bigger than aircraft. I mean, it's huge. And then you sort of look at the World Bank figures. Afghanistan had a total income from intellectual property of $385 3 years ago. The system as it now exists extracts a tribute from the rest of the world for the benefit of the old countries, principally the US, but also the UK and the EU do very well out of the system as well. But nobody else does. Everybody else has a deficit and pays money out rather than getting money back.
Sounds like a Roman way of having the vassal states pay tribute.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's not merely what it looks like. That's what it is.
Well, I'm sure we can keep going for considerably longer because it's a fascinating topic and hardly a small one, but sadly it's time to wrap. I wonder if you could leave us with just one or two thoughts on what do you think, you know, what does good look like in this space in 10 or 15 years?
Okay, so I think that what good would look like should be decided by not me and not a handful of people. But what would good would look like is if we all came together and said, what do we want? First, understood how we got here. And as David was saying, that this is not foreordained, preordained, sorry. This is not something that people sat down and say, okay, this is what we want. But it's just a happenstance of how things worked out in history. So I think if we have a public debate about this, and in very much in the way that they used to have in the 17th and 18th centuries, where people, sort of philosophers and others, weighed in on these subjects. Today, these things are not decided. They're decided by these administrative bodies. They might be decided by lobbyists lobbying for a particular law to extend, you know, the copyright term, or this WIPO, which is this international agency in Geneva. But the public at large, I would say, doesn't understand that it actually has a big stake here. And so maybe get people to vote on it. I mean, you know, get public engagement, educate the people and say, look, this is what's going on. It does affect you. You don't understand it. What do you want? And this is the perfect time to do it, because we've got a revolutionary technology like artificial intelligence that's coming down, and none of us has any idea what the world is going to look like. So it's time that we all sat down and actually decided and voted on it. David, what do you think?
I agree with you. The problem is knowing how to get the public to speak on its behalf. It has always been the problem, not just in this domain, but in many others. You know, who, I think Kissinger, you know, said, you know, what's the telephone number? You know, how do I call the public? And somehow we have to find a way of getting a general common interest to coalesce into a form of speech that speaks for the public and without vested interest or a stake or skin in the game in particular bits. But I would also say, and I suspect Alex agrees with me, even if he's not going to say so, the outcome of any such discussion would only be good if it ended up in some kind of curtailment, scaling back, tamping down of this monster that encroaches more and more everywhere and everywhere. In particular, the length of copyright protection, which is so different from that of trademark or patent or any other kind of IP, should be brought back to what Victor Hugo declaimed in the 1880s when international copyright was first invented, that creative works should indeed belong to their authors for their lifetime and then stop and then belong to the whole world. That I would have thought would be a good outcome, and it would affect 99.5% of creators not one bit. Either because their works don't earn anything or because they are not so foolish as to think that they can be encouraged to create once in their graves. so I think, you know,
John Lennon notwithstanding.
That's right. But you can see why corporations that own these rights do their very best to keep dead authors alive, because copyright in posthumous work runs from the date of publication, not from the date of death. So that would be one thing. And the other would be a really serious reconsideration as to whether we really mean it when we say that an employer is an author. I mean, it's just nonsense in the ordinary state of the English language. And yet that's the thing on which many of our big creative industries rest. And there's something wrong with that.
Interesting. I was not really aware of the history of copyright. I thought I was aware of current copyright laws, you know, having worked in the internet industry and the DNS industry, we come across that quite a bit. But your book has a lot of very interesting tidbits and anecdotes that illustrate how crazily this thing evolves through the centuries. So thank you very much for this really insightful, important, and timely book and conversation.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this TechSequences podcast. We are Leslie Daigle and Alexa Rod. You can reach us by email, techsequences@techsequences.org. We'd love to hear from you to know what you thought about this episode or ideas for future episodes. TechSequences. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook and subscribe through your favorite podcasting service.